We've all had challenges at work. The checked out boss or the micromanager, the peer who seems to put in a lot less work than everybody else and never gets called out for it, or the one willing to say or do whatever it takes to get ahead, including deliberately making other people look bad. If you're not crazy about your job, is your problem with the work you're paid to do, or is it with the people you're paid to work with? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It's often up to those affected by colleagues' misdeeds to make sure their careers aren't damaged by them. And as my guest has discovered in her research, the most effective response to counterproductive bosses and team members will depend on exactly what form their bad behavior takes. Tessa West is Associate Professor of Psychology at New York University and author of Jerks at Work, Toxic Coworkers and What to Do About Them. She joined us in March, and today we're listening back to that conversation. Tessa, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So these people you call jerks at work might well be an impediment to our career progress, but even if they're not, they can just make our lives miserable, right?
Yeah, I think one thing that happens at work is we often underestimate how low-level conflict and stress really impacts us. So everything from just the sound of someone's heels walking down the hall and you know they're coming to harass you about something or suck up your time or give you negative feedback, you know, those low-level things can really eat away at our well-being, our physical health, our mental health. But I think most of us believe these are the kinds of things that are just to be expected at work. We should just suck it up, deal with it. This is the workplace. Do the best we can under those circumstances. And my research shows that's actually not very productive. And, you know, these low-level things can really add up and negatively affect us in the long term. So it behooves us to learn some strategies early that we can practice to help deal with these difficult people at work.
And what's interesting is that, you know, some of these folks may be bad at their own jobs, but not necessarily. So we can't just wait around for someone else to notice they're not performing. They might also be considered like a really valuable employee within a particular organization.
Yeah, I think actually some of the most difficult jerks I talk about are very clever. You know, they bring value to the team, to the organization. Your boss really likes them, or, you know, there's something about them that's rare, that's hard to find and difficult to replace. So they're just not going to get fired. And I think the difficult part about dealing with these folks is we often feel like it shouldn't be our responsibility to fix the difficult people at work. But if we kind of sit around and wait for others to do it, or we hop jobs and we think it's, you know, the grass is going to be greener, that's not a good solution either. And so, yeah, I think kind of the most difficult people are the clever ones that have charisma, they have talent, they know exactly what to say. They know how to actually say nice things about you behind your back so that they don't look like they're petty, you know, and they're gossipy and all of those skills that we tend to underestimate in our jerks at work.
We feel like after years in our careers, we ought to have the skills to deal with toxic colleagues, although it's not something most of us are ever actually trained to figure out, right? Does it surprise you that there are no management classes in universities or whatever that look at how to deal with hard colleagues?
Yeah, I think it's shocking and not. So I've actually done a lot of work working with doctors and, you know, medical staff, and they don't even receive training on how to do things like, you know, tell someone that they have stage 4 cancer or deliver really tough news. So folks like that aren't getting training on how to have kind of interpersonal tough discussions. The rest of us are really, you know, really not going to get it. And I think, yeah, I'm a social psychologist by training. I should be good at this. And I've had a difficult time. I don't know anyone, you know, from, you know, entering the workforce all the way up to CEO of a company that's ever received any formal training at the beginning of their career. There are these kind of punitive things we do to people, right? So they screw up at work, HR puts them in some kind of, it's a little bit like driving school when you've gotten too many tickets. It's like, you know, you've been bad at work. Here's your kind of microaggression training program that you punitively have to take. But that's the only time you really do any of these things. And most of it is done when we're already kind of mad and irritated that we have to learn these things and nobody else does. It's treated as a punishment instead of just kind of like basic curriculum we have when we enter the workforce.
Okay, Tessa, let's talk about some of the forms these terrible colleagues can take. What is a kiss up, kick down coworker?
So a kiss up, kick downer is someone who knows how to climb the ladder at work by any means necessary. So they tend to be comfortable with kind of stepping on the toes of people who work at the same level as them or beneath them, sabotaging people, insulting them, or shaming them publicly. But the boss loves them, and it's usually because they bring some kind of talent to the organization, but they're also really good about saying the right things about you behind your back, so that they don't get a reputation as being toxic. And so, they're difficult to deal with because if you complain to the boss, you're going to be the one who looks really petty and often jealous of this person's performance.
How do they try to gain advantage outside the workplace in order to grab power really early in their tenure?
Yeah, I mean, these folks will really think outside the box. So there's a couple of different types that are really good at this, pressing the flesh outside of typical work environments. So kiss up, kick downers will find out where the boss works. They will find out where they hang out on the weekend, where their kids' soccer games or football games are, whatever it is to kind of kiss up to them. They also are really great at not just finding the locations of where to approach bosses and other power players, but they'll offer to offload work that these folks really need some help with. So they're really good at detecting bosses who are feeling overwhelmed at work and could really use a helping hand. And they'll kind of step in and offer that, which makes them invaluable. So they're good at that kind of where to go, but also what to offer when they show up. And they tend to be very pragmatic and utilitarian in their approach. So bosses are like, great, I would love if you would interview all those new interns for me. That just saved me 20 hours, and then instantly become invaluable.
One weakness of these kiss up, kick down coworkers is that they're short-sighted. How does this tend to affect them?
So a lot of us sort of forget that the workplace structure, the hierarchy, the social network is really kind of a moving thing. People go in and out of jobs, they go in and out of offices. You might be in the Dallas office one day, but the New Jersey office the next. So they kind of forget about this kind of ever-evolving component of the workplace. And the minute that they get transferred or, someone else gets transferred in the workplace, usually their relationships fall apart. So they can be very short-sighted in that front. And we know now that, lots of people actually kind of move around offices, and lots of jobs even have kind of formal rotations. So I think that it can be very difficult for them to pull off their strategy the minute that they're transferred out or the minute that the structure of their team changes. And the other thing I'd like to add, and this isn't in the book, but one thing that we know about how people get jobs now is through social connections. The number one way that we actually recruit people for positions, especially top positions in companies, is by going onto LinkedIn or another, website like that and pulling out people's connections and contacting them and having recruiters ask for references out, within your social network that you might not be aware of. So this could also happen to a kiss up, kick downer that, all these people that used to work with them are now kind of willing to put their neck out and say, this person was horrible. But it comes at you maybe 5 years after your bad behavior. So they often kind of don't anticipate how their current behavior is going to affect the reputation in the future.
To the extent that it's helpful to find allies at work who maybe have also experienced these effects from the people giving us problems, are there safe ways to ask around, to find out whether other people agree coworker X is a problem?
Yeah, I think our temptation is often to go to people and say, I've had this horrible experience. Did you also have this experience? And I think, we're looking for camaraderie. We're looking for people who can, make us feel better about our experiences. But this can often be dangerous because you actually don't know who's aligned with your kiss up, kick downer. So I recommend actually finding allies who are a bit at arm's length from you. So not your best friend that you like to, go to the bar with at the end of the day and complain, but someone who's really well networked that you know. In the organization, and find through them people who've worked with your kiss up, kick downer. And then your goal when you approach those folks isn't to complain or to even share your story. It's just to what we call information seek. Just ask about what their experiences were like, good or bad, and if they have anything that they're willing to share or speak to your boss about. I try to go into these conversations as neutrally as possible, just because you just don't know, where people stand with someone. And it could be the case that someone likes your kiss up, kick down, or is afraid of them and isn't willing to stand up against them. So ask questions, try not to share too much information at first, and make them as neutral as possible, kind of refraining from talking about how this person makes you feel, at least initially.
So if the kiss up, kick down person has cultivated a special relationship with the boss, maybe drops the boss's name all the time, how do we get somebody to listen to our side of things when we take those problems to the boss?
Yeah, this is really tough. And I have tried this and failed in a few different jobs of mine. I think, you know, we want our bosses, we want to feel heard when we talk to our bosses. We want them to understand our emotional experiences. And we want them to say things like, I'm sorry you feel this way. What can I do to help? But we often fail to perspective take. So we forget that our bosses are going to lose something, probably a lot, if they were to fire the kiss up, kick downer, or to, you know, put them in a different position where they have less power. These kinds of things tend to be costly for bosses. And so when you approach your boss, the first thing you want to do is actually create a shared reality with this person. So as much as it hurts you and makes you uncomfortable, the best thing to do is to actually start out with something that you know the kiss up, kick downer does well. You know, I know they're great at sales, or I know that, you know, they're very good with customers, whatever it is, so that you can acknowledge their strengths. And then from there, you can talk about what's going on in the workplace that's difficult. Focus on concrete actions that they've done. So, you know, things like, in my case, I was selling men's shoes. You know, this person, quote unquote, displaced all the men's size 10 shoes. So it was very difficult for us to sell. That's an actual thing this person did that others can corroborate. Don't talk about how they were mean to you or mistreated you. Try to avoid kind of ad hominem language that's just about their character and focus on the very specific acts that they've done and exactly when they did it. So note keeping is really key here, writing down the actions. And it helps if you can bring others with you to say, this problem isn't just between two people. It's actually a wider spread problem. This person's engaging these behaviors with a lot of folks, some of whom still work here, some who don't. And we're really afraid it's going to start to impact the culture here or the productivity or the engagement. The bigger the problem is, the more widespread, the more your boss is going to care about trying to fix it because, you know, they don't want to deal with a problem that's super widespread. If it's just between two people, they can easily write it off as just kind of petty bickering. But a bigger problem is much more difficult to solve. They're going to be much more attentive to the issues if you have others with you who also have experiences.
Almost all of us have dealt with somebody who steals the credit for our work or our ideas. Are there ways, Tessa, to set up work teams to prevent credit stealing before it happens?
Yeah, I think credit stealing is one of those things that is very, well, let me back up. Credit granting is one of those things that's actually very messy to do. I think most of us have just a basic human bias to think that we should get more credit than we actually get. And part of that is because we know what goes on in our heads. We know what we've said, but others aren't as attentive to us as we think they are. And because this process is messy, we often get into accusations of credit theft, idea theft, work theft, and so forth. So the best thing you can do very early on is create super transparent processes about who's doing what and when. And even if you work in teams where ideas are in the air, try to write down immediately after that meeting who said what and when. And I think, you know, one thing that can happen in really cohesive teams that work really well together is they use a lot of we language when they talk to the boss. They'll say things like, we came up with X and then we tried Y and it worked really well. And although there's kind of a good aspect of that, it's very inclusive. Everyone feels like, you know, they're part of a team. It can actually backfire when individuals feel like they're not getting credit for their components of this.
Tessa, bulldozers are an interesting category of toxic coworker I hadn't thought about before, although once you described it, I realized I could recognize them. What are some of the bulldozers' trademark moves?
Bulldozers are funny because a lot of us are really used to the person who talks a lot. So kind of this in-the-moment bulldozer, someone who cuts people off, you know, they take up the most space in a room. So those are the kind of typical bulldozers we think of, but the kind of more dangerous ones we deal with at work are the ones who go behind the scenes to pull levers of power to get what they want. So for example, if you work with someone who has a certain person that they want to hire for a job that no one else is on board with, they'll do things like go to the boss and complain that there wasn't a clear process or no one got to say their thoughts and it wasn't clear what you were voting on. These kinds of things that question the process that makes bosses think, this really sounds a little bit fishy. I think we should kind of go back and have this conversation again. And all they're really doing is actually stopping the process from happening. So bulldozers are great at disrupting processes, making votes and an impasse and really just making it impossible for teams to get anything done.
Why have they thrived in this era of Zoom and Teams meetings?
So I have this very bad habit, and I think this is partly why they thrive, which is anytime a bulldozer talks a lot, their face takes up my whole screen and I just put them on mute. And I think I know I'm not the only person who does this. It's a bad strategy for dealing with them because it feels good in the moment. It probably reduces my blood pressure, but it signals to them that they can keep on doing it. And I think what we end up happening in this era of Zoom is we disengage when we encounter a bulldozer. We don't actually deal with the problem. And so they keep doing this over and over again, and often the meeting ends and the only person we heard from was that bulldozer. So we're not really making any progress, but we're not trying to stop them either because it's just too much effort.
Why do you think it's important to pick your battles, though, when dealing with a bulldozer?
So I think, if we fight them on every front, we're going to probably lose out, partly because they just have more vigor than the rest of us. And I also think we really want to take on the issues that disrupt processes, that do things like get rid of, votes and, democratic processes or other structural things that we really value at work. Those are the things that bulldozers try to take down that we should really be careful about protecting. I think, one thing about the bulldozer is you can pick your battles with them. You can also redirect them. Often they're great at sort of lifting up the voices of people who get interrupted a lot. You just have to give them a job to do a task, and they're kind of happy to do it. So I think with them, they're the kind of one jerk at work where they do have a skill that can be useful if we learn how to redirect it or put them, cut out a certain window of time for them to bulldoze the last 10 minutes or something like that, that we can keep it kind of contained. And then it just makes our lives much easier.
I want to talk about free riders, people who manage to, continue to rise in their careers, putting in as little effort as possible while going undetected. How does it happen that free riders can sail along for years doing less than everybody around them?
So there's a few reasons. The first is that I actually think we kind of know at some level they're doing it. We let them get away with it if we're honest with ourselves, partly because they usually have a lot of charisma. They're friendly. Everybody likes having them around. And they target conscientious teams who will just make up for their lack of work. In fact, there's some research showing that the more conscientious teams that have free riders actually they overperform teams that don't have them because they actually overcompensate. So they're smart in that strategy that we will just kind of make up the work for them. So we kind of know at some level they're doing it. I think also now, especially with hybrid work, people are pretty siloed off in their teams. My team that meets at 2 p.m. on Zoom doesn't spend any time in the office with the team that meets at 4 p.m. on Zoom. So they can kind of tell each team that they're bogged down with work with the other team, and teams just don't check in with each other. It's kind of like someone having an affair in their marriage where their lover is just in a completely separate social circle from their wife, or husband or whatever. They just don't overlap, and so they can get away with telling the same thing to both groups of people for a pretty long time before they actually, get detected, get figured out.
We can sometimes spot them because it seems like they always have like an excuse or a special circumstance. Sometimes it's some personal thing. Sometimes it's, as you said, I'm bogged down with the work for this other team. How can we start to notice the pattern there?
I think the single best thing you can do to detect a free rider is have people record at the beginning of a project or a week or whatever, the work that everybody agreed to do on something. And then at the end of that week, the work that they did and any work that they didn't plan on doing that they did. And it's that gap where we actually can see patterns of a free rider. So what free riders will do, say they work on a team of 10, is they will equally distribute that work among those 10 people. So no one person really feels the burden. But if you get those 10 people together and you look at their lists and all of them have one thing they did that week that they hadn't agreed to do ahead of time, they can easily say, oh, this is interesting. We each did one thing. It adds up to 10 things. And all 10 of those things belong to Bob the free rider. So you can really detect that. And I like the strategy a lot because it doesn't require people to tell on someone or to complain about them behind their back to the boss. It just simply creates this reality of work being done by others that was initially agreed upon by your free rider.
You say the goal is not so much to eject free riders as to coax them back onto being productive members of the team. What are some ways we can do that?
Yeah, I think our temptation is to shame them into submission, but we're dealing with folks who are already a little bit disengaged or overburdened or overworked or whatever. So the best thing you can do is to actually bring them in first, remind them of what about them that you miss. We really enjoyed having your creativity here. We really miss your contributions, to beautifying our PowerPoint presentations, whatever it is. Remind them of that and then focus on the exact strategy you're going to use to get them back involved. Sometimes they just want to be heard. They want to complain about how overworked they are or whatever. Give them a few minutes to do that, but really spend the time focusing on structurally what you're going to do to get them to work again and how you're going to actually monitor that for progress. So they can't just get away with charming you and, promising to do something with no plan of how it's going to actually happen. And then you need a plan of what you're going to do if they don't actually meet those deadlines. What's the next step going to be so that they feel like there's something punitive in the future if they continue on with their behavior?
Everybody who has ever been supervised by a micromanager knows how just what a soul suck this can really be. It hurts your confidence. It makes you feel like you always have somebody looking over your shoulder. It's interesting here that you identified that a lot of micromanagers are driven by fear. What are they afraid of?
Yeah, I actually, the micromanager is the one kind of jerk at work I feel a little bit sorry for because a lot of them are just very conscientious. It's just being directed in a very bad way. And part of that is because they're afraid of failure. So, most of us don't get any training in management or leadership. We are promoted into these positions because we are good at our old job, not because we actually know how to manage people. And they're terrified they're going to fail. I mean, they were promoted because they're conscientious, but no one's told them how to do this new job. And so, without very explicit guidelines from their boss, who probably isn't so great either if they're allowing them to micromanage, they're going to do whatever it takes to sort of feel like they have self-esteem again, reduce that fear of failure. And the thing that they're going to do is oversee their old job as much as they can, which unfortunately is what your job is. It makes them feel better about themselves because they're actually good at that and they're confident in it. So to reduce that fear, that's what happens. And most of us feel the burden of that. It's their own strategy of kind of regulating that fear experience. Not by becoming a better manager, but by overseeing and micromanaging their old job, which is your current job.
How can we set boundaries with a micromanaging boss?
I think that most of us try to run away from our micromanagers and hide from them, and that strategy simply isn't effective. So the first thing you need to do in this kind of boundary setting conversation is to actually lean into having short, frequent meetings with this person that allows them to see your progress. I'm talking 5 to 10 minutes a couple times a week. And in those meetings, you have explicit guidelines of what your work is going to look like. So part of boundary setting is having work hours, is having, hours you answer your email and hours that you don't, and those kinds of things. But it's also just giving them clear access to information on your progress. So things like having a Google Doc that just has a list of the jobs that you're working on and your progress for each one and where you are. So if they want to spy on you, they can just go look at that instead of bugging you and stopping by. It reduces their anxiety and it creates boundaries between you and them and the communication that you really need. I think, you also need to have conversations about goals. So part of the reason why boundaries are hard for these folks is because they have one goal for you, and it's often not aligned with what your goal is for yourself. And so you need to have that conversation of where they want you to go, where you see yourself going, and what it takes to get there, and what exactly needs to be accomplished for both of you to do that. That's part of a boundary conversation as well. So that way, when they start to kind of seep into areas of your job that are outside of those boundaries, outside of those goals, you can remind them, this isn't related to what we talked about. These are our five goals, and I'm working on all of them. Let's have it. If you want me to do this new thing, we can have a conversation about that after we first accomplish these first five things. So that structure is really critical to kind of keeping them on task.
I think your insight earlier is really interesting that micromanagers tend to especially target people who are now doing the job they used to hold. Are there ways to help them understand that there are lots of ways to be a good, whatever, employee X, and it's not the way they did it isn't necessarily the only way to do it right?
Yeah, I think this is also a real problem we get when conscientious people are promoted. So, it's easy for us to say there's other ways of accomplishing this, but the organization, the workplace, has given them a raise or a promotion into this leadership position because it's kind of implicitly signaled to them that they have the right way of doing this. So I think these conversations about there's other ways of doing this have to be mediated by another person in power, another leader, maybe a colleague or coworker of the micromanager that you can approach to get a little help with the conversation. Because as someone who has less power than them, it's hard for us to say, there's other ways of doing this. Just trust me. Let me show you. It helps if you bring in a third person, someone who knows your micromanager well, that works alongside them, but is maybe not super involved with them, to say, okay, listen, Tessa, this person is trying this approach. How about you hear them out? Here's what's good about that. Here's why there's utility to that approach. But it's really hard to do that on your own.
Is micromanagement usually like a company-wide phenomenon, something that is facilitated by the very top?
I think what the very top does is it doesn't encourage micromanagement. It just doesn't teach people how to be good managers. And if there's a culture of fear of failure, then you sort of have the perfect breeding ground for micromanagement. You take a conscientious person who's afraid to fail, that isn't getting any instruction from the top, and you can add some kind of company level structural issues in there, like too many reporting layers. There's a manager, an assistant manager, an assistant to the assistant manager. These kinds of things do come from the top, but I don't typically see organizations that encourage micromanagement. They just don't teach anything at all. And the default strategy is micromanagement. In fact, something like 90% of people have encountered a micromanager at some point in the workplace, and that's just because that's what people's intuition tells them is the right way to manage.
Is there a way to tell the difference between a boss who's a micromanager and a boss who is just quite detail-oriented and is trying to hold everybody to the same high standard?
Yeah, I think that's a really critical distinction. And I've had people complain to me that they have a micromanager, but in reality, their job just required kind of micro attention to detail. So I think the question you have to ask yourself is that attention to detail critical for me to do my job well? Or am I doing a whole bunch of kind of nonsense work that's being micromanaged, that's not actually helping me move forward? If the attention to detail is critical for you to perform well and to actually climb up the ladder and move forward, then that's very different than an attention to detail that feels like you're kind of going in circles, or you're pushing that rock up the mountain, it's just coming back down, and you're doing that over and over again. And the way that you can see that is by looking at who your micromanager has worked with in the past. Are these people working really hard and getting promoted and, learning new experiences and growing? Or are they working really hard but not moving forward at all? In fact, they've kind of been stagnant in their positions at work for the past, 2, 3 years or whatever. So I think that's a critical distinction. I also think if you feel like you're being micromanaged, it's good to ask around to see if others are experiencing this too, because it could be the case that your boss just simply doesn't trust your work for good reason. You're assuming it's micromanagement, but they're assuming you just don't really know how to do your job. And that's where that goals conversation can actually really help you kind of detect the difference between a micromanager and someone who just really needs to pay attention to detail.
All right, we have micromanagers at one end of the spectrum. At the other end, we have bosses who are checked out. So how does it happen that some bosses get neglectful, and what do we lose out on if our supervisor really isn't paying a lot of attention to us and our work?
I think, these supervisors that are neglectful, they often kind of go in and out of neglect. So we lose the attention to detail at the stage where we really need it. What we get with them is an attention to detail at the 11th hour when we don't need it, because they tend to actually micromanage when they're panicking that they've been kind of left out of the loop. They left themselves out of the loop, but that's how they feel. And so, we're losing, the feedback that we need as we go along. It's not really spread evenly throughout the process of work. It shows up when it's just too late to get it. And I think, one thing neglectful bosses do is create massive uncertainty in people, and that uncertainty-based anxiety we experience, our hearts are pounding when we see that they finally have showed up, and we know they're going to exert top-down control over for us, and then we're never going to see them again. So we don't even know if they're going to check on the work we've done. In addition to kind of that lack of systematic feedback we get during the stages we need it, what we gain from them is lots of uncertainty and anxiety about when they're going to show up, how panicked they're going to be, and what those consequences are going to be for us and our performance.
Are there ways to let them know we need more from them, especially if they already seem like genuinely overtaxed?
Yeah, I think you can learn to need nudge a little bit with a neglectful boss, by asking for time with them, but not acting like it's an emergency. So we have a tendency to write these emails that are like urgent in all caps, need to
Right.
meet with you now, because we think that's the only way to draw them in. But that actually pushes them away, makes them more panicked because they don't have time right now. So ask for a meeting 2 weeks out, go for 20 minutes, not an hour, and then kind of slowly work your way into actually offering to offload some of the work that they're doing that they're not actually very efficient at. Things like dealing with time thieves and energy vampires, these types of folks that suck them dry, but are just taking away time from you. So you need that time back.
How common is it, Tessa, for colleagues to actually lie at work or about work and then gaslight those who work with them and know the truth?
Lying is very common. In fact, I think there's one social psychology study showing that like one in five of our social interactions involve some form of dishonesty. So lying itself is super common. I think lying in the gaslighting sense, which is kind of taking it up another level, right? It's like lying with the intent of creating this alternative reality, with deceiving on a grand scale. So gaslighting lies tend to start small. The gaslighter works their way up to create this alternative version of events. And then they cut off the victim socially so that person isn't questioning this reality. And I think that is a very distinct form, a very kind of painful and harmful form of dishonesty that we sometimes see at work.
One giant red flag is a colleague or a boss who will use very positive language when some project is obviously going downhill. But you note it can be hard to spot because sometimes they're telling us lies that we really want to believe.
Yeah, I think, there's some interesting social science research on the language we use when things aren't going well, and kind of the more grandiose, the more overly positive, and the more vague it is, that tends to be signals of dishonesty. Like, things are great, we're doing wonderful here. Everyone's really killing it, we're really thriving. I'm watching the Elizabeth Holmes special right now, and it's super interesting just to kind of hear the language that was used at Theranos to cover up a lot of what was going on. And that's very common at work, I think. And a lot of the reason why people buy into it is exactly what you said. Sometimes the lies feel better than the truth. And we are very motivated to feel good about ourselves, to feel good about our progress at work. And so putting our head in the sand often kind of feels like a better option than to face up to uncomfortable truths. And if we have a culture where everyone's doing this, it's very hard to be the only one to stand up against it and to say, this isn't right. Things aren't adding up here. You add on to that things like groupthink are going on, where the whole team is kind of being cut off from, the perspectives of others. People start to get really insular and don't share information with other people because they don't want to get found out. And all of that can make it very difficult to actually stand up against this form of dishonesty or to even admit to yourself that it's happening.
The Theranos story is a perfect one, context to examine this question. How do gaslighters get good people to consider doing unethical things?
So I think if you think of this as like the frog in boiling water metaphor, you don't just start off by having them kind of jump into the deep end with the most unethical behavior possible. You start off really small, and kind of before you know it, you're doing things that you never thought you'd be capable of doing. And often that you're not even aware of how bad what you're doing is because you don't see the whole picture. So gaslighters will kind of cut you off from all the details and just ask you to do small things. They know how it all adds up to form kind of this big picture of, dishonesty at work or unethical behavior, but you often are just a small piece of the puzzle. And so what they often do is take talented people, get them to do small things, and then hook them in where they have to keep engaging in these behaviors because now they're part of the unethical behavior and they can't simply walk away. There's going to be a serious cost to their own careers, to their moral standing in the community if they do so. And that tends to be how they hook in people. I'd also say they're really good at finding their victims. So people who are suspicious of them from the onset, who document communication with them, send them notes in an email form immediately after something sketchy has gone down, they'll cut these people off very early on in the process. It's the people that don't do that they're more likely to gaslight.
What is I don't know if it's pronounced social referent or social referent. What is that person and how can they help us deal with gaslighting coworkers?
So I think that kind of what you want to find is someone who's well connected socially. So a social referent, actually, now that you say that, I'm not quite sure. Well, let's go with referent. A social referent, this is why I didn't read my own book, because I couldn't pronounce some of the words in it. A social referent is someone who is well connected at work, but doesn't necessarily hold a lot of power. So if you think about someone in high school, where actually we sort of do research on this, they're the ones who know everybody, but they probably, aren't the most popular. They're not necessarily the most well liked, but they're the most socially connected people. And these people will help you kind of connect to others who can help you. Often what you end up needing to get are people who hold a little bit of power, not too much. You don't want to go to the boss's boss, but someone who's well established in the organization, has a lot of social status, who can actually help build that wall up around you to protect you from the gaslighter, who will help kind of build back your social network brick by brick. And a social referent is really critical to doing that, because you're going to be terrified of going to people when you're being gaslit. You're afraid you're going to get fired or things are going to be said about you. And so these people can really kind of help you do that. And they tend to be closer in social status than you. You're not talking about going to the very top of the organization. You're talking about someone who's been working there for 5 years and knows people, but isn't too far away from you in terms of power.
So, look, we are all the stars of our own movies, right? Which makes us not only the hero of our own stories, but the victim overcoming things. I would imagine everybody reads this book thinking, I need help dealing with the other people at work who make things terrible. I am the innocent bystander here. What are some ways we can recognize, that we might be behaving in some of these maladapted ways?
Yeah, so when I wrote this book, I was hoping that people would feel a little bit uncomfortable and think to themselves, I recognize myself in some of these things. And I think, we all, the first kind of step is we're all capable of being a jerk at work. I actually think that, we're not talking about people who have personality disorders or bad apples. I think everyone under the right conditions can become a difficult person to work with. And I think the first step in knowing if that's you is don't expect anyone to tell you. People don't usually give this kind of feedback. At least in American culture, we're very bad at giving negative feedback. Even during exit interviews, we lie to our managers and tell them that we just had this great opportunity elsewhere. In reality, it's because they're all micromanagers. So we're not honest. And I think we sit around and wait for the bad news to come to us. And when it doesn't happen, we assume that we're great at work. And that's not really the case. And so the best thing you can do is actually ask for feedback that's very specific and behavioral, and do it pretty frequently and focus on the small things. So if you have, meetings with your coworkers, at the end of it, ask what you did well, what they want to, see more of, and ask what you could work on, and kind of make it a kind of pattern that everyone does this. It just becomes a trend, a behavioral norm that people engage in. So asking for kind of small, frequent feedback that's very specific is going to be much less threatening, and people are much more likely to do it. I think the other thing is you got to learn what your Achilles heel is at work. So what is it that really turns you into the worst case scenario version of yourself? And for some of us, that's, feeling anxiety and stress at home during the pandemic. That made us really anxious, and so we micromanaged to feel in control. But for others of us, that anxiety made us feel overwhelmed, and we became neglectful. We became free riders. So know what your triggers are that turn you into this worst case version of yourself. You can't control the triggers, but you can control how you respond to them. So create alternative things that you do instead of those bad behaviors. If you're a micromanager, you got to regulate that, feeling that you want to control people. Go for a walk. Just calm yourself down before you do it. Give yourself a rule. I can email people 4 times a day, and once I reach my quota, I reach my quota. I don't get to do it again until tomorrow. You have to learn these things about yourself that are often ugly and not fun and not flattering, but we all have them, and that's okay. So kind of embrace that aspect, and then you'll get much better.
I also think back about the first couple of jobs I had, like in high school and college, I can admit it now. I was not always the most responsible employee. Is there room for people to grow out of these behaviors, or are they often sort of pathological states that people will bring with them to every kind of job they have?
So I think you're not going to like this answer, but both are true. I think there are aspects of us, our weaknesses that we carry with us from one job to another, but we can learn how to control them. Just like any bad behavior in life, we do this with our spouses and with our kids. We have instincts to say maybe be Machiavellian and step on people's toes. And you put someone in the right context and those things are going to flourish. But we can learn to control them. We can learn to get that feedback. We can learn to kind of see the warning signs that we're starting to go down that path and then kind of get better at it. But the key here is you have to be motivated to want to change, and not all jerks at work are. So, the kiss up, kick down, or they are definitely motivated to kiss up, kick down. And unless they're going to be explicitly punished for their behavior, they're just going to find environments where they can thrive. They're going to look for that fertile ground, that super competitive workplace where that kind of thing is encouraged. You put them in a place that's like very egalitarian, there's a flat pay structure, these kinds of things, they're not going to seek out those jobs. So you do have some people who are kind of motivated to be jerks. Those folks are really hard to change because they don't want to. And the same is true for gaslighters. But most of us don't fall in those dimensions. We actually just kind of suck a little bit sometimes, right? We free ride when we're exhausted. We credit steal when, we're not paying attention. These kinds of things that we micromanage when we're fearful. And those are the ways, those are the things that we can control. And I'd say that's like 90% of jerks at work actually fall into those categories.
So, what are the lessons here for the people who manage these folks who can be toxic, including folks who might manage other people beneath them? How do you avoid inadvertently rewarding a toxic coworker because they are producing for the company but making everybody else around them miserable?
Yeah, I think one thing that managers do poorly, and it's not entirely their fault, they don't have much control over their time, especially middle managers, is they hand off communications to other people. So the single best thing a manager can do at any level is to have short, frequent meetings with their team members so that they can detect difficult jerks at work early. And they can put steps in place to prevent them from thriving. And often these steps are structural things like, asking people what work they agreed to do and didn't agree to do, or, having these checklists so that you don't end up with credit stealing and these kinds of things. These structural things put in place early can stop jerks at work from thriving and can detect them. But you have to be willing to have those one-on-one conversations with everyone in your team and not offload a lot of that work to your stars. So what we often see is managers will have someone like a kiss up, kick down, or come to them and say, "You don't need to meet with all those new employees we just onboarded that are two levels beneath you. I'll handle all those meetings for you, and I'll come back to you and report to you on how everyone's doing." And they're thinking to themselves, "Great, I don't have to worry about this." But what they're doing is inadvertently handing over power to a jerk at work. So they have to actually pay attention to those little warning signs. The other thing they can do is don't ever ask employees if someone is being a jerk because they probably won't tell on them in most companies. You can ask them specific behaviors that will tell you whether someone's being difficult at work. So ask about those behaviors. Don't ask about people's, opinions of how they feel or about people's reputations because they don't want to gossip, especially to the boss. Lots of people are very cautious about doing that. But there are ways of kind of pulling this information out of people that doesn't require them to, gossip about or say negative things about the people they work with.
Are there ways to know before you sign on to work with a particular organization that there might be problems there that are going to be greater than whatever pay bump or position adjustment you might get by transferring?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest source of information we have now that we never used to have is our social networks. On LinkedIn. And I think communicating with people who used to work at a company is really key. And one thing what you'll end up finding with like learning about people's reputation is, let's say you reach out to five people who used to work with your boss and you ask them what that experience was like or if they have any advice. If you get nothing back, they don't say anything at all. It's just like crickets. That's just as telling as if you get feedback, because what people will do is they won't say anything if they have something negative to say. So we see this in academia a lot. If you're asked to write someone's tenure letter, the number of people who just don't respond to that request is considered a huge diagnostic piece of information. So consider that information when you're moving forward, that no news is often bad news because people aren't willing to kind of gossip about others, but seek out that information as broadly as you possibly can. Talk to people who already work there. Talk to people who've transferred out. Talk to those who are successful, those who aren't. As much broad feedback as you can get, the better. And the one thing you have to be very careful of is don't just seek information that confirms what you already think. You know, if you're really gung-ho about this job and the raise is huge and it's in the perfect city for you, don't just go to the people who succeeded. Go to the people who failed too. So you have to learn how to play devil's advocate to seek information that might disconfirm what you're thinking. And we're not very good at that. We usually just ask the people who we know are going to already confirm what we think, and that's where we make a huge misstep because I think lots of companies tell you who they are. You just choose whether or not to listen to that.
Tessa, thanks very much for spending your time with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That was our conversation from March with Tessa West. She's an associate professor of psychology at New York University and author of Jerks at Work: Toxic Coworkers and What to Do About Them. You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our handle there is at KERA Think. And do subscribe to our podcast for free wherever you get your podcast. Just search for KERA Think. You can also get the podcast on our website where you can find out about upcoming shows. That is think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.